ago, I was teaching a class in Davison cosmology and you know, perturbation theory and blah, blah, blah. And some students came to me and asked me, oh, you know, this is all very nice and interesting. Maybe we can learn how to construct interacting theory of dark matter and dark energy. I said, really, why would you care? They said, well, you know, there are all these bumps in the dark, like measurements of the Hubble constant as a function of redshift due to, I think, BOSS, it's called BOSS, yeah. An experiment surveying baryon acoustic oscillations and so on and so forth, that they say suggests some interesting discrepancies with the lambda CDM. And that, of course, that sounds very interesting. But then I said, how would you ever model interacting dark energy and dark matter and so on? And they said, well, you know, people write lots of papers about this, and they imagine that there is something like quintessence, and that it has couplings to dark matter, which could be like a fermion, and the coupling is Yukawa and so on and so forth. And in fact, actually, if you go and look at the literature and so on and so forth, indeed, there is lots of papers in the hundreds, okay, about this for quite some while. But then I look at it and said, this is nonsense. This just doesn't make any sense, because if you actually consistently consider whether you can construct such a theory, such a framework in quantum field theory, using the standard rules of quantum field theory, this just doesn't make any sense. It's basically excluded, constrained to oblivion, okay? Effectively being excluded. And then we played with this and sort of, you know, tried to come up with some alternative things and so on and so on. And actually, to my surprise, we did find, basically the bottom line is decoupling. Decoupling is the problem, as it always is. Okay, because heavy and light don't like to mix. Okay? That's the bottom line, and that's always how it works out in these cases. But then we found this kind of funky exception of sorts, which involves dark monodromies, and that will be a positive side of this message. I'm not going to say that we have an absolute no-go theorem, because we haven't gone through a survey of all perverse things that you can imagine that might be interesting in their own right, okay? But at least there is an obstruction that one has to worry about, and it's a bit of an exercise of just how much physics you can learn from few simple Feynman diagrams.
And this is just, so you're saying decoupling, maybe decoupling, you shouldn't, it works.
It works.
Yes.
It always works.
Yes,
hallelujah.
Indeed. All right, so let's go on with this business. So right, who cares? Well, they tell us that the universe is mostly dark, right? I mean, there is 95% of the stuff you don't see but feel through its gravity. And lambda CDM says, well, you know, basically just some significant amount, basically billiard balls, invisible billiard balls, and a single number. It's a perfect fit. All the data like it. Have been liking it for the last, what is it, 20-something years, okay? Come on. You look at the visible stuff and it is far more, you know, the few that you have are far more diverse and interesting than all this boring stuff. Well, you know, what we have so far found is maybe really it's just some billiard balls and a single number and so on and so forth, but we still don't know yet. And actually, frankly, I think if you have any heart left to you, as they say, you don't want this to be true. But it just may end up being true. So in the meantime, though, we can at least try to look for consistent models that might currently fit the data in a way that, you know, reproduces the successes of lambda CDM, but leave in there some bumps in the dark that could be detected in you know, the things that we will be using to explore the universe further down the line. So there is a possibility, in other words, build a straw man that our colleagues, the experimentalists, may find useful for their searches, and who knows, maybe you get lucky. So the question is, can the dark sector be more interesting? Now, I'm gonna make one starting assumption. Quantum field theory works, okay? I'm not going to abandon it, I'm not going to do anything exotic with it, I'm going to assume the standard quantum field theory of textbooks, I'm going to assume that gravity couples, you know, that gravity doesn't exist if you go to a locally Lorentzian frame, and so on and so forth. So just the, you know, hard-nosed, hardcore conventional stuff, and ask, can I have, within this context, within this framework, okay, a consistent setup where there are quantum field theories that describe interacting dark matter and dark energy? So suppose dark energy is not just a single number, and suppose Well, that means I'm looking for some quantum field theoretic description of what eventually becomes fluids that interact in some non-trivial interesting way so that they can affect the cosmological observations. And they, in other words, whether they mix in some sense. Now, like I said, there is a lot of literature, but I would say basically, surprisingly to me, almost none of that has dealt with you know, quantum microscopics of the it's basically just studies of gravitating fluids. So, what's the idea? The sort of philosophical cornerstone is this concept of radical conservatism, which people, well, you know, I think maybe we don't hear enough of it. Okay, in some sense, it's attributed to Wheeler, but Wheeler attributes it to Bohr. It essentially means make assumptions that you know that what works here on the Earth works everywhere, and just push it to the extremes and see how far you can go. So let's model. Let's look at ingredients. Let's imagine that dark energy is not a single number. So it's some field. It has dynamics. Let's be conservative. You know, if in this business, quintessence has become conservative, okay? So imagine there is a light field. That field has a potential that it can roll along, so it can change in time and space, but it does it ever so slowly because the potential is very, very, very shallow, okay? The curvature has to be less than Hubble. Now, that basically means the mass of this field, if you call it that, is going to be less than 10 to the minus 33 electron volts. Of course, you have a burden of proof on finding a way of how to get such a tiny number out of any fundamental theory and so on and so forth. But let's just say now that there might be some, okay, you can resort to axioms to do that. Some variant, by axiom now, I will not mean a QCD axiom, okay? But axiom-like particle, okay? In other words, a pseudonumber Goldstone, which is, in a sense, a complete copy of the standard PK axiom, or maybe not a standard PK axiom, depending on where it comes from. Okay, it couples to some gauge vectors and so on and so forth. Gets to have its perturbative behavior controlled and protected by the field theoretic shift symmetries. It gains potential from non-perturbative gauge effects, such as instantons. And ultimately, I will also look for, I will attempt in a phenomenological bottom-up way to implement a condition which will provide a hope, okay, that non-perturbative gravity corrections for this kind of axiom that could be realistically dark energy are also met. In other words, that I will try to implement conditions on the axiom sector in such a way that not even the global symmetry breaking effects induced by wormholes would in fact bespoil such a flat potential. Okay, so in a way, that's what, as a field theorist, that's the best thing you can do. Okay, beyond actually finding a complete UV completion of this within some UV complete framework and then deriving this as, you know, simply just using mathematics from the top down. All right, so let's assume now, like most of the literature that I've searched, that dark matter is heavy particles. For example, WIMP or some such. Now, to code the interactions, you can just imagine that the mass of the particle, of the dark matter particle, depends on the dark energy web. Okay? Now you do the next thing that a sane field theorist would do, which is expand in Taylor series. Okay? And look at the terms that you get, and you're going to get some sort of expansion and so on and so forth. And obviously, you'll have the constant in the leading term. And I'll just say here the terms which are avatared by the dot 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 are in fact generically irrelevant for interactions between dark matter and dark energy from the point of view of an observer who is looking for observational consequences.
Pi is dark matter field.
No, psi is dark matter.
And pi is the dark energy.
Correct. Okay. Now. In other words, in the absence of the linear term, the interactions are already tiny. You can have, for example, a quadrilinear bit, or rather a double bilinear like phi squared, psi squared in the theory and so on and so forth, but direct interactions at the classical level that this will mediate will be small.
Yeah, so this makes for a Hubble mass particle, C has to be tiny.
Let's get to that.
Ah, okay.
Amazingly enough, that didn't exist in the literature. Okay, in a clear way. It's a vacuum expectation value of the field on a very flat potential, so no. Okay?
So not an actual particle.
It's a homogeneous condensate of the field. Okay? Think about the Higgs. If you just look at the V, okay, it's just a cosmological constant. Okay? Now, so let's look at these bounds. Now, so to leading order, this is what you need to focus. If you ignore this, you can. In principle, if you impose some symmetry, you can preclude the linear term, then you got basically nothing to leading order. So let's not do that. Let's go on and see what happens. Well, here is what happens. If you have a Yukawa like this, you immediately get two simple Feynman diagrams to worry about. This one is the analog of the Coulomb force diagram in QED. And the other one is the analog of the photon polarization diagram, except there is no gauge symmetry to here to protect the external field from getting a mass term, the momentum independent term. Okay? And you can easily calculate what these do. And in fact, actually, the first diagram, this is a one, well, you don't even need to calculate, you know the answer. You open up, you know, Mandel and Shaw or whatever, if you had forgotten it. And you just write down what this is. Now, nominally, the dark energy field is massive, so there is a Yukawa suppression, but in order to be in slow roll, the mass is tiny, so at all sub-Hubble distances, forget about Yukawa, this is just 1 over r potential. So you're getting an extra force. And now, interestingly, of course, because of the standard normalizations and whatnot, the way how we actually chose this parameter C was precisely in order to express the normalization of that potential in the appropriate units for comparison with the data, namely to normalize the overall scale in the Planck, in the units of the Planck mass or Newton's constant. So you basically get C squared times the standard Newtonian potential as an additive correction on top of the gravitational potential the two dark matter particles feel acting between them. Now there is the other diagram, the loop that gives you the dark energy correction, mass correction, and this part that I've identified here, that I've pulled out here, is in fact only the finite part, residual part. This is not the cutoff. This is not the UV sensitive bit. That's thrown out, okay? Let's just say, imagine some, you know, that is an irrelevant thing. It's cutoff sensitivity, which can be renormalized away and should be renormalized away and so on and so forth. This is really coming from the fact that the dark energy field in the theory with the Yukawa coupling has a form factor and introduces a contribution due to that form factor from the virtual dark matter particle that it spends some, you know, tiny amount of time as. And this log here is crucial because it tells you that this is really a running term, a real physical term, that you cannot cancel away by a single renormalization. You could in principle imagine, of course, if you're subtracting a divergent part from a divergent from a UV sensitive quantity, you can always add an arbitrary finite bit to the counter term and cancel whatever you want at a certain fixed scale. But this log here tells you, okay, that if you cancel this term by a finite renormalization at a scale m and then go to some scale m prime, that cancellation will fail. Okay, the problem with this is the coefficient, okay? This coefficient is controlled by the fourth power of the dark matter mass, okay, divided by the two powers of Planck mass, but nevertheless, okay? This is generically much, much bigger than current Hubble scale. And that, of course, is the reason why this coefficient has to be small, okay? So now you go and look at the bounds.
But that depends on the dark matter mass, but you have very low.
Yeah. Let's look, I'll show the plot in a moment. The answer is yes, but even then, let's wait. Yes, but you're anticipating correctly. Let's look at the data, okay? Now, there is in fact some bounds on how dark matter couplings. They're not very good, and they're non-trivial. They have improved by about an order of magnitude. I in fact actually got the dates right. It hasn't been 25 years. There was a question about 25 years ago that was brought up by Josh Freeman and I think a postdoc at the time in Fermilab by the name of Gradwall. On basically testing equivalence principle in dark matter sector. And the data in roughly 92, let's say something like that, basically said that dark matter interactions could actually differ from baryon-baryon interactions by order one. That got better, in part by improving, by improving cosmological data, but not only cosmologically, also actually some local experiments now. Some local data now exists. I'll tell you, astrophysical, not clearly not lab, okay? But I'll tell you in a second.
But it's not solar system scale,
galactic scale.
Yeah.
Galactic. I'm talking about the stability of the Milky Way spiral arms.
Oh, okay.
There is this business that involved people like Kamiunkowski, Kasdan, Peebles, and so on and so forth. The bottom line is that as the solar system spins around, it spins very slowly, okay? The solar system, since it began, had made maybe about 100 revolutions, order 10 to 100 revolutions. I don't remember the precise number. But it is doing that in the vicinity of two Magellanic clouds, which are presumably most of all that mass is mostly dark matter, but there is a fair bit of visible baryons. If the dark matter and baryons gravitated, or rather had different long-range forces between each other, in a way that was more than about 10% or so, it would have distorted the shape of the Milky Way spiral arms. That's the claim. There are some claims that it might be avoided and so on and so forth. But if you take it seriously and also combined with cosmological information from the control, you see, dark matter controls the growth of large-scale structure.
I guess technically it wasn't really as far as this, like, the final tails of the cycle of galaxies.
Yes, that's right. In other words, they would be basically misplaced. The baryons would move faster or slower relative to the dark matter in the arms. Yes. Okay. So with this, you know that basically the bound is the difference in the dark matter to baryon can't be more than about a tenth, which tells you that this number C is about at most one third. Independently of the other scales in the theory. That's just pure long-range interactions and so on. Now, the other formula for the dark matter, for the dark energy, it tells you gives you an additional inequality. Again, the problem is the fact that this correction to the dark energy mass goes as the four powers of the dark matter mass. And if the dark matter is heavy, then even the Planck suppression may not be enough to keep that number under 10 to the minus 33 electron volts. So you dream on having an ultralight, dark energy, and the moment you turn this interaction, unless C is uber tiny, it's gone. So you can summarize the plot essentially. It's fairly simple, okay? The moment that dark matter mass goes big, the coupling has to decrease dramatically. If masses are very light, then you got no problem with radiative stability, but the dark extra force still constrains you in a significant way. Now, there were some attempts to change this story. There is this so-called, I never know how to pronounce it, but it's obvious that they wanted to call it MAVENS because it sounds so cool. So in the version one, the idea was that you have basically a much heavier dark energy field, which is in a way the idea being it is sort of suspended in slow roll, not because of the flatness of its potential, but because of a counterbalancing effect provided by the dark matter in the environment in which this dark energy field supposedly moves and essentially producing an additional viscosity, if you like. Well, the problem is that this, what they needed in order for this to work, well, first of all, they needed couplings to be direct couplings of this dark energy field. To very heavy stuff were prohibited. They wanted it to couple to milli electron volt particles, namely neutrinos, sterile and visible. Okay. Secondly, the problem is that those couplings needed to be too strong, if you like. And they would produce an instability in the neutrino sector precisely because of the fact that at distance scales shorter than the Compton wavelength of the dark energy field where there is no Yukawa suppression, the neutrinos would suffer the extra long-range force, and they would actually start clumping, forming these nuggets. And this was done in the work by Afshordi and Zaldariaga, and who was the third guy?
Corey,
thank you. In response, a version 2 was proposed, but okay, that one may have some features to address the problems. But in a way, it's hardly a perfect way of dealing with dynamical dark energy, because the version 2 is basically just a scaled down hybrid inflation. For most part, implying that what you call dark energy is actually just a field in a totally flat potential that's designed and suffering from all radiative problems and so on. Well, actually, I had a little bit of a problem even with their equations in the precisely for this reason, because I'm not even sure that there were certain formulas offered, but we can talk about that in detail later. I'm not quite sure that the background field proposed to be the dark energy was actually solving the equations properly.
Okay.
And I can give you a little bit more of a private history of some of these statements later. But yes, this was actually the question that I asked Neil Weiner shortly after they proposed the paper at some conference in Florence.
I think I just put it by
hand. I'm afraid it's a little bit worse than that. Really? Okay, yes. But yes. Now. In any case, you know, regardless of all of this, the coupling that was ever utilized and permitted was only to milli electron volt particles, namely to neutrinos. Now, there is not a lot of neutrinos in this world, okay? And we know this because of the fact that there are bounds on how much warm or hot dark matter we can have. So in a sense, actually, if you can come up with a model that couples with dark matter, not just neutrinos, at least when it comes to looking for some way of introducing imprints on the cosmological, you know, properties, on the geometry of the universe and its disturbances, you'll do better. Okay? So in a sense, let's see whether you know. On the other hand, this type of argument, okay, seems to be quite prohibitive. Okay? Well, and so for a while I thought, okay, this is all just, you know, from a microphysical point of view, if you really desperately want to have interacting dark matter, dark energy, that's not just simple stuff and whatnot, you have to abandon quantum field theory, and I don't like that. I don't want to do that, okay? But then, actually an idea came from Axion Monodromis and from remembering what is it that it takes to even have a hope of generating a plausible theory of large field inflation at high scales, remembering the conditions that you need to impose on axion scales and couplings there, and then simply scaling everything down. So let's explore this. So this is the simple way around. Okay? Imagine a theory with three axions. One is light. This is the dark energy one. Okay? Another one is heavy. It's a dark matter. Okay? Now there is the third one, the intermediate one. Let's call it Goldilocks. Okay? Which is too heavy to be dark energy now, but not heavy enough to be all of dark matter. And therefore, perhaps in the regime of mass scales, where in fact, you see, the bottom line is that in the previous, the bounds and the plots for the exclusions that I showed you previously, all had to deal with decoupling. The point was that if you have dark energy that needs to be very light and dark matter that needs to be very heavy, if you want them to coexist, the cross couplings need to be tiny. Because even if you ignore their effect at the classical level, quantum mechanics will produce corrections which will tell one sector about the presence of the other, and then, you know, heavy will not want to stay, well, light will not want to stay heavy, okay? And the forces induced on heavy by the light will be too problematic. So here is the thing, okay? How do we, so let's start with a, I'm not going to give you too much background on the theoretical side about this, but I'll kind of comment on it as we go along. Imagine that, what I will do is for most of the rest of this, I will actually ignore the third axion. I will focus on the ultralight and the Goldilocks, okay? The ultralight axion means there is, in principle, in this potential, an extra term that involves some, well, this is kind of a bit unfortunate, but another mass scale, okay, times another cosine-like term that depends on the third axion field, but in such a way that that mass scale and the third axion's decay constant are such that the quadratic term in the expansion of that missing bit, that ignored bit is much bigger than the current Hubble scale. Okay. Now, you may ask me, why couldn't you do it with just two axions? Why do you even need this third axion? The reason is that about 15 years ago or so, maybe, there was a kind of very interesting, very curious paper by Barbieri and a cosmologist, Amendola, okay? Who wondered, you know, intelligently whether in principle dark matter could be some very light axion, and found actually that if the axion's mass is less than about 10 to the minus 27 electron volts or so, then in fact the problem is that such a super light axion, okay, tends to be is a component of dark energy at very early times. And then when the universe cools to the point where the Hubble time at that time is equal to that axion's mass, namely 10 to the minus 27 electron volts or so, that axion falls out of slow roll and starts and converts essentially into dark matter asymptotically by going first through an intermediate stage where it is slowly catching up and trying to realize its potential kinetic energy oscillating around the bottom of the potential. And those oscillations change the cosmic behavior at early times in a way that can be used to impose constraints on the amount of energy stored in this degree of freedom, effectively because of its effect on cosmological perturbations at those length scales, and also because of something else, namely the integrated Sachs-Wolff effect, because basically photons learn as the structure is being affected by the conversion of this axion from dark energy into dark matter, that something is going on through the fact that their redshift, let's put it this way, there will be an imbalance between the redshift falling into the potential wall and blue shift falling into the potential well generated by this and redshift coming back out in order to reach to us. Roughly speaking, at that time, the bound on the contribution of energy density from such a Goldilocks field, okay, was about 10%. The plots in the Barbieri paper look a little bit more severe than that, but they actually took the plots not to be entirely reliable. In the meantime, the improvements of CMB physics have led to better numbers, but still you can get away with about 5%. So that's what we're going after here.
Between masses of what? 10 to the minus 33?
Yeah. 10 to the minus 29, 27, something like that. I don't remember precise numbers. Okay?
Yeah, that's why. Yes, I know. Is it still only 5? You can still have five.
About 5. It's big. It's big. This is this business. For example, post-BICEP, we looked through some of these papers that were placing bounds also from isocurvature constraints and so on and so forth. The 5% appears to be a reflection of these, you know, there is this Pedro Ferreira papers and a few others and so on. That's where the 5% comes from. And in fact, it's the second paper by these people who consider the effect of this transition on perturbations in cosmology a little bit more precisely than the first paper. And this is, you know, the upper limit, okay? Now, so what's the point? Why do we have the three terms here? Why do we have three terms for two fields? Shouldn't be enough to actually have only two of them. Well, the trick, as I will try to go along, okay, is to actually see one of the axioms you might say is the ultralight, the other is somewhat heavier. The third term is going to be needed in order to make the ultralight field sufficiently light without making its axiom decay constant super Planckian. That's how the business of monodromy works, okay? So you basically imagine that you have all the parameters in the theory sub-Planckian. Why do you want sub-Planckian? Because of the fact that non-perturbative gravity effects will produce additional corrections to this potential that will break even the discrete. Notice that this, the theory is, of course, now completely invariant if you shift any of the phis by a 2 pi times integer times f. That is a remnant of the original unbroken continuous shift symmetry, which was broken to the discrete infinite subgroup by the gauge instanton terms that led to the generation of these cosine potentials. And these cosine potentials are, of course, only the leading order terms that you obtain in the dilute instanton gas approximation, where you're calculating the non-perturbatively induced potential for the fields, okay? So if you then, on top of this, consider what will happen if you introduce, if you ask questions about non-perturbative gravity corrections, you will get additional corrections, okay? And the standard lore is that they are weighted by the exponents of the ratio of Planck scale in the numerator and the axiom decay constant in the denominator. So if the axiom decay constant is super Planckian, then the weighting term is very is of order one because the exponent is close to zero, okay? On the other hand, normally to get the axiom to be ultralight, you need to have the axiom decay constant to be, if you didn't have anything else, the axiom decay constant would need to be at least M Planck or more for this axiom to ever have a chance to be in the slow roll. You see this in the standard lore, and this is just a usual story about slow roll inflation. If you have a potential like M squared phi squared, phi needs to be super Planckian in order to be in the slow roll, okay? But since this potential comes out from expanding a term like this, if f is small and you take phi super Planckian, then you're just not expanding around the right minimum, okay? You're not expanding the right vacuum, and therefore you are again not going to be in the slow roll. So the only way you can actually manage to get the axiom, or rather whatever, phi field, okay, with a cosine potential, hence the axiom, to be in a slow roll is to stretch out the potential and make the period bigger than M Planck. And yet if you do that, then wormholes come in and kind of eat you. Gobble it up by basically producing corrections on this. The claim is making it completely unreliable. So the trick with this business of axiom monodromy is in fact to evade wormhole corrections by keeping f less than M Planck, such that wormhole corrections can be safely ignored and, you know, forget about them. Okay, while simultaneously somehow stretching this potential enough without ever utilizing fundamental degrees of freedom that are super Planckian. Now, how do you do that? Now, you know what monodromy means? Well, I'm not asking the Greeks. I'm not asking the Greeks. Greeks don't count. It's Greek, of course. It means single road or single trajectory. Okay, single pathway. Well, in other words, it really stands for getting a long pathway. So how do you get a long pathway, okay, in a non-trivial way that seems to actually traverse a very long distance in a theory where a fundamental periodicity is very small? Well, there is actually in mechanics, so maybe the best example, best simplest intuitive example, okay, and this is how actually this misaligned potential with multi-cosines really works. It's beats. Okay? Remember what happens when you basically start to superpose waves with different frequencies. Okay, let's say the frequencies are similar, but not quite the same, and that they're not commensurate, that their ratio is not a rational number. Okay, so then what happens is you look at the waves, and obviously as the phase changes, as the phase evolves as a function of space and time, what happens is the cosines oscillate generically out to phase, but because of the fact that the frequencies are incommensurate at some points in time or space, okay, they'll come close together, and because the frequencies are close to each other, they'll stay together for a longer time, remaining in phase, and actually interfering coherently, and maintaining, in other words, not producing these big long wiggles that would destroy the flatness of the potential, but instead actually giving you these flatter plateaus. A very simple experiment you can do, although you need to have a mirror with a hole in it. Suspend the mirror, okay, over some kind of horizontal pivot, and in front of the mirror suspend a little mathematical pendulum. They'll have different moments of inertia, so they'll have different frequencies of natural frequencies of oscillation, okay? Then wiggle them both. And just look at the image of the pendulum in the mirror as both wiggle, okay? And then amazing things happen, you know, the image of the pendulum is doing crazy things, and then suddenly kind of goes still. Those places where you want to be that you can use to support the slow roll for longer are where the pendulum goes still, where the image of the pendulum goes still. All right, so I think I've sort of told you this. Now, except for the bottom line, right? This looks exotic. It is exotic, of sorts. Three axioms, right? Who? I remember the phrase people used the commonly repeated nonsensical phrase in the physics of dark energies, who ordered that? Well, you know, that being paraphrased to Occam, but actually the problem with that is that, you know, you can use Occam's razor only when you have theories. When it comes to dark energy, okay, other arguments are invoked. So we need a kind of an argument, at least a motivation. Well, one motivation may be an axiverse, okay? If you really have a framework within which actually a plethora of axioms are natural and they kind of repeat over various scales, something like this might not be entirely insane. Okay? And I will actually get back to that again a little bit later. So here is actually, in a sense, how it works at a kind of semi-technical level, all right? First of all, you can start by considering the normal modes of the system. Now, whatever the potential, if you expand it to quadratic levels, you know, you can always diagonalize. You can always go to normal modes. This is basically just some kind of a mixed harmonic oscillator with 2 degrees of freedom. You can diagonalize the quadratic part of the potential. And actually, it takes a little time, but you can convince yourself that if you constrain the potential only to quadratic terms, okay, then in fact, this diagonalization is good for all cosmological effects, including linear perturbation theory. In other words, if you constrain the potential to quadratic terms only, including bilinear interactions and so on, the cosmological observables to leading and subleading order just don't know about it. You can always get rid of the cross term at a bilinear level by a field redefinition, and you'll be none the wiser for it, okay? So in order to actually see an interaction between dark energy and dark matter, you have to go beyond the quadratic terms in the potential. And in this particular case, because it's cosines normalized, with values normalized to unity, that actually means you have to go to the quartic term, okay? And so generically, quartic terms are small, right? If you're expanding and so on and so forth, that's the idea. Except actually that in this case, what you're doing, because of when you want the flat light field's potential to come out from monodromy, it means that the mixing of the quartic term, the mixing at the level of the quartic term, has to contain the energy density in there comparable to the energy density in the normal modes, in the quadratic terms, at initially. You're guaranteed that has to happen, or otherwise you will not have good enough extension of the length of the path, okay? So here is how you do it. You basically first diagonalize it. These are the normal modes that you solve for by expanding the potential to quadratic terms only and diagonalizing and then using that field redefinition working back into the potential. This is the heavier light field. This is the lighter light field. And notice that if Fs are sub-Planckian, okay, you never, from each individual term alone, you never get much of a long path. As long as you're expanding all of these fields around phi, L and H equal to zero. In other words, if you pick to expand them around the same vacuum. But because the potential is periodic, you don't have to expand about the same vacuum. Okay? Any vacuum is as good as any other. Okay? So you expand the heavy field about some vacuum where its wave is not equal to zero. Okay? Then, due to the mixing, the light field realizes that its vacuum is not at L equal to zero, but due to this bilinear bit that involves the contribution from the wave of the heavy guy, it knows that it must go to this displaced minimum. And this displaced minimum can easily be super Planckian, even if no fundamental scale is ever Planckian, because of the fact that you have moved the vacuum several units away, okay, employing this residual discrete shift periodicity of the shift periodicity of the potential. So this term simultaneously, now you, as long as you require this field, the heavier field, to be of order 5% of dark matter, that's an assumption, mind you, okay, it didn't have to happen. You could have just chosen initial condition where this field is nailed to its minimum, sits there, and doesn't contribute to anything. But if you actually take this game seriously, then all light fields will, during inflation due to Brownian thermal drift, inflationary drift, be displaced away from their minima at some generic scales comparable to the axiom, to the periodicity of their potential. And you actually don't expect that this field will be completely passive, but it will have been excited, set up at this order F term, somewhere in its potential, waiting for the universe to cool down until it learns that it's now heavy enough and can start to oscillate. Once that happens, and once you maximize its amount, essentially bounding it by the constraint of Amendola-Barbieri, you are guaranteed that the quartic cross term that survives in this expansion will initially have significant contribution to the total energy, fraction of the total energy density. It's very funny, actually, that it works like that. So now what you do is, of course, you know, this is, quadratic equations are very simple to solve. You can solve everything exactly. But as I said, you gain no new insight because of the fact that, you know, when you rewrite everything in normal modes, all of the information about mixing disappears. Okay, so you got to do this numerically, and you stick this potential in there and pick play with the, you scan the initial conditions until you meet the basic generic constraints and fit the lambda CDM at some high redshift, and then you evolve. So here is the Hubble parameter. The theory has been in the units of the Hubble parameter for lambda CDM. The decoupled model, let's just be slightly for comparison, okay? This decoupled model is where you by hand turn off the mixing between the Goldilocks and the ultralight. You want to see how the story set changes. Now, in that case, if you want the ultralight to be the dark energy, you need to make its axiom decay constant trans-Planckian. That's not theoretically realistic, but you can ignore that and simply just see what the equations look like, and then you go back to the theoretically more appealing model, which is involving the mixing where you're generating the large trans-Planckian excursions from the relevant minimum by the monodromy effect, and compare.
So you have to assume a specific answer.
Yes, of course.
This is
for one particular choice. You can scan clearly. This will go down, you know, if you get closer and closer to the minima. On the other hand, you know, this, of course, at some hidden level involves some anthropic thinking. And in that way, what I really mean by is the following. There is absolutely no anthropic reason that will favor me, you know, to have any particular value here of sorts, except that it needs to be small. Okay? The point is basically, what do you think about the likelihood of certain initial conditions? Okay. So if you say that if you make the what appears to be mostly a common assumption that the distribution of initial conditions is essentially uniform and unbiased, except for the offhand, you know, cutoff that you need to satisfy in order to meet the data, then you just go and say, okay, you know, I'm going to be basically near where with uniform distribution of initial conditions, you'll be basically where there is most possibilities, which is near the maximal deviations from the vacuum. So if that's the argument, you might say this actually might be kind of likely, okay? Notice the main of sort selling point is that in order to get dark energy axion to actually avoid the quantum gravity problems, you need monodromy, which then with this argument of large initial conditions tells you that you expect interaction. That's for better or worse, that's the best kind of, you know, argument that I can give you about this. So here is more. Let's see. So with those initial conditions, okay, that you scan, you do scan them. Here is more deviations. So this is a plot of contributions to the critical energy density for various setups. Okay, this is the model which involves monodromy. This is two axions without the coupling. Okay, and then this is the standard lambda CDM, and you can sort of see what. Now, why? Just an interesting thing. Okay, why even without coupling you seem to get some kind of effect? The reason, of course, is that the Goldilocks guy, even without the coupling, falls out of slow roll at some relatively recent time, and by recent time in cosmological scales. Let's say you take its mass to be 10 to the minus 29 electron volts. So at some time, which is, you know, what is it, redshift of order 100 or so, okay? This guy learns that it's now heavy enough to start to oscillate. But it doesn't immediately start doing this. It doesn't have time, right? Its characteristic frequency is given by its mass, which is comparable to the Hubble time at that time. So it's just beginning to sort of slosh around very slowly. And these kinds of signatures, which involve the deviations of the variation of various cosmological parameters, are the reflection of the fact that this guy didn't have enough time to thermalize, to virialize yet. Okay? So similarly, you plot the equations of state. And see, there are blips. At this level, okay, this is obviously with the argument that the initial conditions are maximized. Okay? In principle, they could be perhaps within the future reach. Okay? Yes?
What are you assuming for the mass of the dark matter? Is it sub-Hubble?
Yeah, sub-Hubble.
Sub-Hubble.
Yes. Yes.
So what happens if you start changing the hierarchy between the Goldilocks and the dark energy?
Well, eventually. Then this goes away.
Yeah.
This goes away. Okay. But then, obviously, it's simply just suppressed, you know, decoupling works. In fact, actually, I'm not showing you the details, but basically, suppose you want only two axions to be all of the dark universe. In other words, forget the third guy, okay? The question that you now want to say, can you now start raising the mass of the Goldilocks to outside of the Amendola-Barbieri window so that it's now all of the dark matter, which actually means that it was heavy enough that it fell out of slow roll early on in a universe, let's say, prior to the era from which we are getting data from cosmological observation, so that it's totally unconstrained. Well, you can actually see that in that case, in this limit, the actual mixing between the two axions is suppressed precisely by that term, that number n, okay, which is enhancing in the near mass limit
the field excursion.
Yes, the field excursion. Thank you. Up. This guy, if you expand in the heavy limit, actually in the quartic terms, in the interaction terms, appears in the denominators. And basically, the bigger it is, you know, the less you have. This is precisely what decoupling does for you.
So, Nemanja, quick question.
Yes?
Let
me show you. I'll show you what we have done. Yes, we have done a little bit of this.
Is this a fixed point? How sensitive you are with respect to your initial conditions?
Now again, you are sensitive to initial conditions. If the initial conditions are such that the fields are closer and closer to the respective minima, if you choose them to sit exactly the minima, you got nothing. Okay? But again, you know, statistically you don't expect that. Okay? If the argument is with a uniform distribution of initial conditions, that you are where there is most chance for you to be, namely just the phase space volume, then you will actually think that you are going to get a maximized effect. Okay? Clearly, there is also sensitivity to parameters. If you start decoupling them, making one heavier, then the effects go away. What I'm trying to say with all this is, I'm not claiming a prediction. I'm claiming a scanning. Okay? I would not want to ever really make a firm prediction about anything that involves dark energy without actually claiming I can solve the cosmological constant problems consistently to begin with. Okay? What I'm saying is that there is a bottom-up approach. If you actually go and ask your friend, the observer, you know, 10 years down the road or whenever, when LSST brings in the petabytes of data they've been promising to us, whether they see something and they say yes, do you say, oh, wow, you know, I abandon quantum field theory, or you don't? Okay, so I would say don't rush to drop it. So this is just a plot of kinetic versus potential energy and this effect from delay of realization. Here is a little bit of perturbations. Now notice, of course, these are the perturbations that were brought into the horizon. Okay, they appear to be big. The reason they're big is those are short-scale perturbations which came in and spent some time inside the horizon and evolved and got bigger. So they're scaled up by the amount of redshift since the decoupling.
No, but this is just the redshift lambda CD, that's what you're showing. There's some suppression compression.
Yes. Absolutely. That's right. So all the plots are fiducial. In the sense, hoping to sort of, you know, the point being really the following, okay? There is some bump. Would I, because of all the issues with initial conditions, sensitivities, and so on and so forth, ever put my money on any particular number? No. What we have here, okay, is a theory space of sorts, of possibilities, and part of it is basically the philosophy of scanning through the axiverse with the standard assumption of uniform distribution of initial conditions, seeing what you get. More perturbations with some bumps. But let me get to something curious, though. The interesting thing, by the way, is that this sort of came as a bit of a surprise, actually. We didn't really expect this. That cosine potential, we discovered this numerically, OK? In fact, my student found this. She was playing and playing and was very persistent. And at first, it didn't make sense. But then the point is basically that when you maximize the parameter n's contribution to the expansion of the, to the lengthening of the path of the light field, okay, you're also turning in the cross terms, the quartic in particular. And there is a fairly large regime of phase space where the cross term is strong enough so that when you start with the heavy field in one vacuum, the energy that it gets, the push that it gets from the light field, is strong enough to pull it over the maximum. Okay? So the field actually jumps from vacuum n equals 10, okay, to vacuum n equals 9, at the moment when it learns that it falls out of the slow roll. So in other words, you have basically, due to this completely classical interaction, effectively an induced phase transition. Now, a phase transition could be a complete and total disaster. It basically means you're producing a domain wall in a very late universe. Now, domain walls in a very late universe spell tremendous amount of danger because of the fact that they can lend CMB, okay? They can do lots of bad things to CMB, and to actually look at the original paper, there is a paper by, of course, Zeldovich from, you know, I think this is a classic, 1960s, whatever, okay? It's an ancient paper. What's the idea, okay? Domain wall has tension, because it has, and some finite thickness. Because it has tension and finite thickness, you can basically just calculate its gravitational field, well, its gravitational field, of course, is linearly proportional to the distance away from it locally, but you can simply just approximate the effect by comparing the total amount of active gravitating mass due to the domain wall to the total amount of active gravitating mass of the surrounding universe. What do? You take the amount of the domain wall that fits in one Hubble volume. That tells you what the area of the domain wall is. Then you take the thickness of the domain wall and the energy density and calculate the total mass contained in that Hubble scale sheet of material that the domain wall is comprised of. And then you compare that to the total mass of the of the surrounding universe in that same Hubble volume. And the ratio needs to be, roughly speaking, less than 10 to the minus 5 if you want the CMB to remain unaffected. Okay? Now, and this looks like a complete disaster because, you know, we are playing with these Fs, the Fs, by the way, that I didn't tell you numerically. We are taking the axiom decay constants in order to have a hope of being protected from gravity corrections. We take them to be in the regime of, let's say, you know, 10 GOT, okay? Up to 100 GOT or so. So roughly speaking, few orders of magnitude below Planck scale. They're huge, okay? So you might think, okay, because of this, there is a serious danger, okay, that the domain wall that is characterized by such a huge scale will contain a tremendously large energy density and therefore will mess everything up and, you know, just forget it, okay? Well, the trick is actually that the way to estimate the energy density, okay, of this domain wall, you have to take into account the potential properly. Namely, the potential is a cosine. It's a bounded potential. Okay, because of this, and your domain wall comes only from as a separatrix between two nearest neighbor minima. So, what is a cosine potential? It's a Taylor series in infinitely many powers. Okay, but if you're only looking at effects between two different minima, all you need to do is basically take that cosine and expand it, and then keep only the terms up to quartic. All other higher order terms actually characterize, if you like, effects that describe the influence of the minima farther away from each other than one. Okay? So if you're interested in finding out the energy density, the surface density, the tension of the domain wall separating two nearest neighbor minima, all you do is you expand the cosine, keep quartic terms, and look at what you get. And basically the expansion of the cosine is just this. Okay, where this is the cosine for the heavy guy. The trick is that the effective quartic coupling is in itself dependent on the axiom decay constant, which appears in the denominator. This is the reason why actually there in the end is no problem.
Well, can I ask something about the moment of this? You assume that the single domain
was
the Hubble?
Yes.
Well, is that really
good assumption because you have a Z and symmetry in the
potential. So
the Goldilocks. Several is still few.
No, you have C, so this would be.
Let me show you the numbers.
Okay.
That's the trick, okay? Let me show you the numbers. The trick is basically the tension of this domain wall, when you actually calculate it, okay, is in fact very small. Okay? It's very small because of the fact that the effective quartic coupling contains four powers of the effective axiom decay constant in the denominator. Okay? And that means that the total energy per domain wall, okay, is in fact given by the ratio of the smallest axiom decay constant to the Planck mass and further suppressed by this factor that enhances the excursion in the field space, and in addition, we are actually sloppy with the coefficient here. The coefficient isn't one.
So this should be a lower, given the symmetry that you have, there should be a lower, an upper bound on the mass of the Goldilocks field, because if you start dominating that number, if you start oscillating regularly, that number should be enhanced by the Z factor, the redshift, because you will have more domain walls coming into the Hubble.
This happens if the redshift is small.
Yeah, if your qubit happens, yeah, but you have a Goldilocks field that happens at Z over 100. What if it's a Z cubed?
No, okay, we'll talk about that later.
Okay.
Okay, but no.
I don't know, but it should be enhanced, I mean, by this ratio, made it times, it's enhanced by z factor. I think it's just z. No, it's not linear. Because this is such, this is what I don't know, what's called parastatic domain one network. It's a z symmetry. So it scales differently than the usual scale.
We'll check the details.
Okay.
There is a small fraction of the total dark matter energy density left up in these domain walls that would be irrelevant in that case as well.
Yeah.
And because you're adding extra power, but if it would be.
No. I agree. There is a regime, but the point is that early on, if you start, that scales differently than a dark matter density, right? So it diagrams much more slowly. But there's a scale factor.
It's much smaller to start with.
Sure, but I'm saying it scales with the additional powers of gets diluted by less two scales.
It doesn't get created so early on, such that would produce such a huge numerical discrepancy.
You've checked this?
Yes.
Okay. This is all I wanted to hear. If you've checked this and you know this, then I'm happy.
Good. Now, let's summarize. Okay? Finally. So the main message, okay, is that, again, surprisingly, you can have something without abandoning quantum field theory altogether, and without violating decoupling. I mean, decoupling is there; it controls the setup. Still, okay, you can actually end up having some non-trivial effect that could, in principle, be detectable by future experiments. Okay. You know the price to pay is that you have to have additional I degrees of freedom. Now they could be dangerous, right? So you need a framework within which that can be realized, and one such framework, perhaps, is the Oxyverse. Now I don't know whether Oxyverse exists or not. Okay, you know, in some sense, so far, whenever I was doing something that had to do with experimental predictions, in the end, I turned out to be wrong. So, if but you never know. Sometimes, you know, there has to be a time that you get lucky. So, maybe.
You only have to be right once.
You only have to be right once, exactly. You know what? That's right. You know, what was it? Let's put it this way. At least I hope that my blunders do count into the category of the topic of the last night's talk here, right? At least some. In any case, let me stop here. Okay.
Okay. Thank you very much.
I'm not sure if you addressed my problem. So I would guess that as soon as this field that makes up 5% of the dark matter starts oscillating, that the condensate is going to fragment on order a few oscillation times. So you're going to be because you've made the nonlinear terms important. That's important to your story. Whenever you do that, you're going to have how much presence.
They dilute quickly. Numerical exploration shows that nonlinear terms are more or less playing the role within, you know, one Hubble time at the time when the transition occurs, and then the interactions drop fast.
But that's still, I still would worry.
No, we have not considered that part in sufficient detail. In fact, there is also one other thing that we also realized we did not consider in detail. Look, I mean, in a sense, much of this, I would say, was, let's put it this way, this initial exploration into viability of the idea. The other assumption is that, you know, we are, as in all the plots I showed you, we basically assumed that the amount of dark energy in the Goldilocks field, okay, is in fact adiabatically conserved. By adiabatically, I mean, basically, you know, the standard scaling law after the initial period where the cross term, you know, plays some role, and then decoupling tells you that they will separate as the Goldilocks field starts to be realized. That's actually, in principle, not quite right, because of the fact that there is still all these dark gauge bosons that have produced the potentials for these guys that these guys couple to. okay? And some could be light. So in principle, you could also have a decay of this oscillating axion into some sort of, you know, ultralight dark gauge theorem producing dark radiation. That could also, in a late universe, be an additional problem that leads to additional effects and bounds, especially because of the fact that, you know, you're getting, if that process exists and if it's efficient, you could end up producing, you know, 5% dark radiation in the universe that could be a problem in the late universe, erasing structure and so on. So no, there are these questions that you know, in other words, we have never thought enough of a full detailed analysis of very late cosmology in order to fit the data yet.
It could be interesting.
It could be interesting, I mean.
I think if you turn that 5% into, you know, reasonably large homogeneities, then,
you know, there's some weird low-level stuff in the team. You know, you know, my impression was that when we first started discussing this, and this was for a while, you know, essentially mostly with negative connotations, initially, it was partially motivated by, you know, my students basically were very interested precisely in trying to fit, you know, these oddities in the data and so on. But then I got the impression that basically after BICEP took the fall, I mean, you know, a lot of people in the community at large kind of lost courage, you know, to push the search for you know, and sort of, I was sort of sitting.
I trust 7 sigma as well, I trust 2.5 sigma.
You know, so I figured, you know, I.
The theory shouldn't be smart because the problem is.
Right.
Direct the theoretical ideas, that's the problem.
Right.
Data's not the problem.
Right.
So if you check how much can you make, whether these effects are detectable of interactions, because you had some plots and there's the fact that the thing starts oscillating at a later time. So how you look at experimental prospects between these things?
Our friends, we actually talk to professionals who do this, okay? I will not trust myself, you know, matching anything to the data and making such precision forecasts. But the bottom line is, we talked to some people involved in Planck, and they basically told us that at this point, we showed them the plots that we could find, and in particular these evolutions of perturbations, modulo the things that we haven't considered, okay? And they told us that at present, it would appear to fit the data well enough to be called degenerate with lambda CTF. On the other hand, they also say that some of the effects can, in principle, be within reach of LSST. And of course, in part, that's based on you know, the W, well, but also on these perturbations at very large scales in the sky due to the dynamic nature of dark energy. Okay? That's the best I can tell you at this point.
So I have a question. So, and this goes back to Matt's question. So you show that path of perturbation is a function of K.
Uh-huh.
I'm just wondering how. Did you include perturbations of the fields here, or you assume the fields were just a constant dark energy?
The this is the perturbation of the Goldilocks.
This is perturbation
of the heavier field. Yes.
Okay, but in this calculation, so it's the consistent perturbation that includes the perturbation of light and heavy, or it just.
This is just the heavier guy. We have done this.
The light one, does that touch it or not?
We have ignored its fluctuations.
Okay, I think that could be. Because that the light one is the one that actually mediates the fifth force between the heavier.
Fair light, enough.
And
fair.
It could lead to instability that we found from neutrinos, but I mean, I think it's also close to the art of the instability that Matt is thinking.
Fair enough. I think that might do something at just the moment of the transition.
Yeah.
How much will it do? Bottom line, I think it will do nothing too serious given the data now because of the fact that what it is doing is it's affecting only 5% of dark matter.
Well, but it's the 5% which comes at delta rho over rho of 1 that compared to 10 to the minus 5, that would be.
Yeah, it will not, I think it will not evolve that fast. Right,
that's right.
Very good. I think that's right. It simply just didn't have enough time to evolve. In a way, by the way, I think actually, no, I think that's actually, that I wanted to say this has been somewhat looked at, but I think they haven't. You know, these, Amendola, Barbieri, and also these later papers, you know, that did this reanalysis of the universe with an ultralight axion, I think never actually considered this type of perturbation, precision perturbation theory in detail.
Yeah.
I think that that's correct, actually. So bottom line is that we do not have a quantitative answer, but I believe that because of the fact that it didn't have too much time, and because of the fact that the effect is essentially, indeed, there is a very light field that's mediating, but the bounds are, you see, the energy density, the relative influence is controlled by the energy densities, but it's the same quantity that controls the gravitational interactions as well. Mm-hmm. You might get something comparable to gravity on the 5% of the, but probably not more. Yeah, I don't think so, but you know.
Let's thank Hermione again.